to this presentation, just so we won't lose it for the second presentation. So I hope that won't bother you. Yeah, turn your chairs around and just listen today, okay? So I hope we'll have time for questions. We've got a tight schedule and people are going to be going back and forth from two sessions, so we're going to try to keep tight timing here today. Thanks a lot. Here's Matthew.
I'll let these people get seated. Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm going to start by drawing your attention to the original title of my talk, which was Folk Music on the Air, Forgotten Roots of the Revival. Now, I'm not going to try to define folk music here, although I will make some distinctions, and I won't concern myself with every kind of folk music that could be heard on the radio in the 1930s and 40s, but I will say there's a lot more of it on the air than people realize. Radio, by its nature, is ephemeral. It's of the moment. In that era, Arthur Godfrey and Mary Margaret McBride were heard daily for decades, and they had a major influence on our culture. They're forgotten now, though, in a way that, say, movie stars of the same era are not. You can turn on to Turner Classic Movies and watch Humphrey Bogart or Marilyn Monroe. Most of the broadcast excerpts I'm going to play for you involve Alan Lomax, a native of Austin, Texas, who became the preeminent field recorder in North America. It's less known that he worked extensively in radio in the 40s and 50s. And in fact, from 46 to 50, it was his main activity. He did almost no field recording in those years. He always had a knack for recognizing the power of a new medium. And in radio, he took full advantage of the unique opportunities he was given. And in the surviving broadcasts, we can hear how he and his collaborators used his field work, that of his father, John Lomax, the folklorist B.A. Botkin, of whom you'll hear more later, and others, as the basis for a different kind of radio program. And I think you'll also hear the emergence of a folk revival musical style that would find favor with a mass audience in the 1950s, as played by the Weavers and others. Now, as I say, folk music of one kind or another had been on commercial radio almost from the beginning at both the local and national levels. There was the Grand Ole Opry's and the many imitations of that, and it got fairly exotic even on the networks at times. Rudy Valley hosted Calypso singers on his weekly show, and Bradley Kincaid, a great pioneering country singer, had to sing, his version of Barbara Allen became so popular that he had to sing it on a network show called the National Barn Dance every Sunday night from 1932 to 1934.
Okay. Are you ready, Hezzy? Contact.
Nowadays, we remember the records, but back then, radio was a much better way to reach people. It gave you regular exposure to a large audience. On one 15-minute local broadcast, you could reach tens of thousands of people, and a national broadcast could reach millions. Rural musicians reached a large urban audience in this way, and one of the beneficiaries was a Midwestern hokum outfit that you're now hearing, the Hoosier Hotshots. You can learn all about them at HoosierHotshots.com, extensive website devoted to them. This is a recording from 1935, and they're commenting on the phenomenon of hillbilly music on the radio. Them hillbillies are Mountain Williams now.
Population all in tears. They came to town from them nor hills, but now they're flashing dollar bills. Them hillbillies are Mountain Williams now. Oh, shook their boots and overhauls and even dropped their high balls. Them hillbillies are Mountain Williams now. They left down home. Around in motor cars, them hillbillies are Mountain Williams now.
Now, classical music programs were very popular on the radio in these years, and some of them strive for a common touch by featuring opera singers performing Cole Porter and Gershwin songs, and you know, you even get Lawrence Tibbett singing Home on the Range and the like. And there would be the occasional orchestral setting of a folk tune. Now, here's Deems Taylor, who was sort of the voice of classical music in those years on the radio, with a introducing a selection to be played by Andre Castellanets and the NBC Orchestra. This is from 1937.
Every country has two national anthems, the official one that's used on state occasions and the unofficial one that generally comes to mind when things get really serious. We have one, for example, that certainly voices no sentiments of lofty patriotism. Yet if you were knee-deep in the Sahara Desert or stuck fast in the ice floes of Greenland and heard this tune, you would know that there was another American in the neighborhood. Mr. Castellanets and his Chesterfield Orchestra are going to play you a new arrangement of it now. And if you don't recognize it, we'll ask some American what it is.
There was a lot of that going around. In 1939, Alan Lomax was then 24 years old, and he was dividing his time between Washington, D.C., where he was at the Folk Song Archive at the Library of Congress, and New York City, where he was taking graduate courses at Columbia University. Now, in the 1930s, CBS and NBC were consolidating their positions as the first national broadcasting networks, and in Washington, some people were wondering if anybody should have a monopoly on the airwaves, and whether or not there should be some requirements for public-spirited or educational programming. William Paley and David Sarnoff, heads of CBS and NBC, respectively, did believe that there should be some such programming, but they were more concerned about government regulation, so they were working very hard to make the case that it was unnecessary. They were going to make so much enlightening and enriching programming that regulations were superfluous. And one such effort was the American School of the Air on CBS. Every morning, for half an hour, grammar school classrooms could tune into an educational program on CBS, and the first show aired in 1930. In 1939, Lomax was recruited to host the Tuesday morning slot that was devoted to music. Years later, he acknowledged that he had his doubts about this matter. Quote, "I thought this was a joke. I didn't know that anybody could be seriously interested in working on the radio, a pile of crap. Then I heard Corwin's broadcast, and I did a flip, and I realized that radio was great art of the time. There was a way to do it quick and straight. Well, I took the job, partly because Nick encouraged me and said it would be an opportunity. He was always a good writer. He had a sense of theater and drama, so it was with his encouragement that I learned how to write a script. It was the first time that America had ever heard itself, and it went into all the schools." Now, Corman was Norman Corwin, a great radio writer and innovator. Nick was Nicholas Ray, best known as a film director. He went on to direct films such as Rebel Without a Cause, Johnny Guitar, The Lusty Men, They Live by Night. At that time, he was in the New Deal theater circles, and he'd even done a bit of field collecting for the Library of Congress. So Lomax became the host and writer for American School of the Air broadcasts. At first, he was expected to do most of the singing himself, but wherever possible, he brought on as guests the best traditional singers that he knew. Some of them had recorded for the Library of Congress extensively, such as Leadbelly or Aunt Molly Jackson, and some he'd met more recently, such as Elmer George, who was a Vermont lumberjack turned car dealer who appeared on the show a few weeks after Lomax met him in North Montpelier while he was working with Helen Harkness Flanders. Lomax, though, had to make a lot of concessions to radio convention, and in this case, it meant, you know, highly scripted shows, and it meant that there were going to be more of these orchestral settings of folk songs. CBS Orchestra. They commissioned 20 different composers to do settings of folk songs performed on the show, something that Lomax really came to dislike. I'll play you just a little bit of a setting of John Henry.
Today's CBS commissioned work is based on the railroad ballad of John Henry.
First, you get the tendentious introduction.
The tune and the words all through the South, and nearly every Southern state has claimed John Henry for its own. It is this ballad which furnishes the theme of today's CBS commissioned work for the orchestra. It's by Aaron Copland.
This follows a version of the song
as
sung by Willie Johnson of the Golden Gate Quartet, who appeared on that particular broadcast.
Spirits in modern music, and his works have received numerous performances in the theater, on the air, and at symphony concerts. Mr. Copland uses two tunes in his work. The first, John Henry Melody, comes from North Carolina and is at the beginning played in the clarinet like this. While the clarinet plays this melody, the drummer beats out John Henry's steep.
The introduction goes on like that for two more minutes, and then you get the full orchestration. He breaks it down part by part, and finally, about 3 minutes into that introduction, you get the full orchestration of John Henry. And that's pretty much how all of these orchestral settings were presented. You know, they'd point out the different instruments which were to represent, you know, the sound of the hammer hitting the spike, or, you know, the mainsail being raised, or something like that. Yeah, exactly. Peter and the Wolf, exactly. So Lomax didn't think too much of this. He comments, you know, how he played every version he had of John Henry for Copland, you know, who would listen to a few bars and say, fine, let's hear the next one. And Lomax says it took him about a half hour to learn all that John Henry, our finest ballad, had to say to him. And I departed with my treasured records, not sure whether I was more impressed by his facility or angry because he had never really listened to John Henry. When his piece was played on the air, I was unsure no longer. My composer friend had written the tunes down accurately, but his composition spoke for the Paris of Nadia Boulanger, and not for the wild land and the heart-torn people who had made the song. The spirit and the emotion of John Henry shone nowhere in this score because he had never heard, much less experienced, them. And this same pattern held true for all the folk symphonic suites for 20 boring weeks. The experiment, which must have cost CBS a small fortune, was a colossal failure and had failed to produce a single bar of music worthy of association with the folk tradition. And Alan goes on like that for a while. He could be very good with invective. As you heard, the composer was Aaron Copland, who eventually did take another Lomax field recording of Bonaparte's Retreat and turn it into one of the best folk and classical music settings. So you get the picture. Let me play you, though, the standard opening of American School of the Air. This is what, you know, a school child would have heard at 9:30 on a Tuesday morning if they were tuning in. The fanfare.
Columbia presents Folk Music of America.
So, I think then one of the most satisfying shows for Alan must have been in January 1940, when he was able to hit the road, leave the orchestra in New York, and do a live broadcast from Roanoke, Virginia, with a great string band called the Bog Trotters. They had first recorded for the Library of Congress, I think, in 1937. John Lomax recorded them, and they recorded several times for the Library of Congress, for which we're very fortunate because they've been ignored by the commercial recording companies. So January 1940, the show switches to Roanoke, Virginia, and the opening changes just a little bit. Still with the fanfare.
This is Columbia's American School of the Air.
Here's the New York announcer.
Where have you been, my good old man? Where have you been, my honey loving dove? Where have you been, my good old man? You're the best old man in the world. What did you get me, my good old man? What did you get me, my honey loving dove? What did you get me, my good old man? You're the best old man in the world.
Today for the 11th program in its Folk Music of America series, the American School of the Air takes you to Roanoke, Virginia, where from the studios of Columbia Station, WDBJ, we're going to have a broadcast of real old-fashioned square dances. And to play them for us, Alan Lomax, our folk song specialist from the Library of Congress, has as his guests one of the best-known bands of folk musicians in the South, the Bog Trotters of Galax, Virginia.
And they got to do a whole half hour with the Bog Trotters. And rather than having an orchestral setting of a folk song, which was, you know, broken down into all of the parts before you got the complete version, Alan had them play the different parts of a tune called Sally Ann, and here's how it went.
Well, Uncle Ack, what's one of the oldest tunes that you know?
Well, among the oldest tunes that I know is Sally Ann.
Would you play a little round of that for us now?
Why, sure.
Now, Davy Crockett Ward here, the second fiddle.
You can imagine,
he looks like he
you know, music teachers
music
across America diving for the volume knob.
Why, longer, I guess.
Say, Mr. Ward, do you know this old tune, Sally Ann?
I've known it all of my life.
Well, would you play it over with Uncle Alec for
you
us now?
You bet I will.
Next to the fiddle, the most important instrument in the mountains and in pioneer America was the five-string banjo. Few people remember that it was the invention of American Negro slaves and was popularized by Negro minstrels, has only been commonly played by mountaineers for about 80 years. Crockett Ward learned to play the banjo 40 years ago or more and taught Wade Ward, his brother, to play. Wade, would you show us how Sally Ann goes on the five-string banjo?
Yes, sir, coming right up.
Fields Ward, Crockett's son, had begun to take a interest in music, the guitar was becoming popular in the mountains. Fields learned the guitar. And now, Fields, suppose you play a little bit of Sally Ann on the guitar and sing a verse or two of it.
Yeah. Gypsy muskrat Sally Ann, gypsy muskrat Sally Ann, picking a banjo and raising sand, shake out a little foot Sally Ann. I'm gonna marry you, Sal, Sal, I'm gonna marry you, Sally Ann.
And now Dr. Davis on the alto harp with the same tune.
Shake that little foot, Sally Ann. Shake that little foot, Sally Ann. Going to the wedding, Sally Ann. Going to the wedding, Sally Ann. Thank you.
can almost hear Lomax saying, you know, take that, Copeland, you know. So that was January 1940. Only 5 or 6 weeks later, Alan met Woody Guthrie for the first time and had only known him a few weeks when the two of them sat down in the Department of the Interior's radio studio in Washington to record what the two of them perceived as a kind of radio demonstration that might get Woody onto one of the networks. He'd already been a successful radio performer in California, so this was really playing to one of his strengths. As Lomax said of these sessions many years later, I wanted the interview used for radio, a hope never realized in those far-off barbarous times. So I slightly pretended that this was our first encounter, and Woody pretended along with me. And with radio in mind, the very first recording they made was a theme song or an opening. Woody on guitar doing a train imitation, and in a few seconds you'll get to hear Alan introduce him as though this were the opening of The Woody Guthrie Show. I kind of wish they hadn't made that the very first recording. They might have gotten a better balance between the music and Alan's voice. But there it is. They thought they were cutting something for radio. Now, I don't know who got to hear these recordings back then. There were 4 or 5 hours of them. They weren't released commercially until the 1960s, although they are Woody's first recordings, and they include some of his best-known material. But in short order, he did get a contract with RCA Records, and he appeared as a guest on American School of the Air with Alan. And in August, he appeared on the pilot broadcast of a CBS program called Back Where I Come From.
From New York, then, back where I come from.
Boys and gals, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight, come out tonight. Boys and gals, won't you come out tonight? Dance by the light of the moon. Or dance with a gal with a hole in a stocking and a heel, kept a rocking and a toe, kept a knocking. Or dance with a gal with a hole.
Tonight's forecast presents the first in a projected series of programs called Back Where I Come From, a program of American notions about topics on which everybody has an opinion.
Oh, it ain't gonna rain no more tomorrow.
Golden Gate Quartet, Josh White on guitar.
Back where I come from, we always say evening red and morning gray are sure signs of a fine day.
Back where I come from, we always say...
Yep, when you see your cat washed behind its ears, it's a sure sign of rain.
Burl Ives.
I always say...
Back where I come from, we always say white Christmas means a lean...
Back where I come from, we always say...
When pigs go about with sticks in their mouths, there'll be a norther in Texas.
Back where I come from, we always say it ain't the heat, it's the humidity.
Oh, it ain't gonna rain and it ain't gonna snow and it ain't gonna rain. No more, no more. I'm the work and the young folks tell that it ain't gonna rain no more.
That's the way it is, folks. Men and women have lived and worked and foretold the weather in the darnest
way. Voice of Clifton Fadiman. Now, American School of the Air ran no commercials because it was an educational program. Back Where I Come From had no commercials because it had no sponsors. But this was not so unusual back then. In fact, it was a way for networks, first of all, they could do more educational programmings and get the feds off their neck. But also, it was a way to test out programs, run pilots. And these were called sustaining programs. Back Where I Come From debuted as a regular 15-minute sustaining program Monday, September 22nd at 10:30 p.m. on CBS. And it was heard at that time on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. 1940. In the beginning, Woody was a regular cast member, as were Burl Ives, Josh White, and the Golden Gate Quartet. And there were occasional guests such as Lead Belly, Earl Robinson, Sidney Bechet sat in on one show, and young Pete Seeger, and many others. Each show had a theme, such as railroads or sailing ships or courtship, and the cast would explore that theme in folk song and folklore. Alan Lomax and Nicholas Ray were the writers, and Nicholas Ray directed. When you take into account the opening and closing announcements, these 15-minute programs really call for scripts no longer than 14 minutes, so they had to make the most of the time. Now here's what became a fairly standard opening for them, and this is actually from a show of dealing with New York and using folklore collected by Ben Botkin.
The name of this program is Back Where I Come From.
Boys and gals, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight, come out tonight. Boys and gals, won't you come out tonight? Dance by the light of the moon. For dance with a gal with a hole and a stocking and a heel kept a rocking and a toe kept a knocking. For dance with a gal with a hole and a stocking and a dance by the light of the moon.
It ain't work that kills you, it's worry. I always say half of what you eat keeps you alive and the other half kills you.
I always say that I don't...
Back where I come from, we always say that the less the guy works, the more money he makes.
I always say all work and no pay makes Jack a dull boy, then.
So they would, they'd, you know, do standard openings like that with little snippets, and then there'd be a couple of short versions of folk songs, just a verse and a chorus, and then individual cast members would get to strut their stuff. So here's Josh White, who was always referred to as Joshua White on these broadcasts, and he's going to do Motherless Children.
Well, you might have thought that song was sad when you was a kid, but me, my favorite song was really blue. You see, I was out on the street leading blind men for my living by the time I was 7 years old. And traveling all over the country, always homesick, and wanting to see my mother. Now, my favorite song was one I learned from one of those blind men about motherless children having it hard when mother's gone. I guess it talks all about the orphan children in this world that need rocking and ain't getting it. Now motherless children have a hard time when your mother is dead. Motherless children have a hard time when your mother is dead. They ain't got nowhere to go, gotta walk from door to door. Motherless children have a hard time when
struggle between folk music and classical now music continues. That's
the best he can when your mother is dead. Daddy will do the best he can when your mother is dead.
And that's the Golden Gate Quartet. You can't really daddy hear them with the noise next door, but
daddy will do the best he can, but your dad don't understand. Motherless children have a hard time when your mother.
Back Where I Come From ran barely 5 months. It was popular, but it could not attract a sponsor. According to Lomax, William Paley of CBS personally killed the show. I don't know that that's true. But there were a number of things about it that were unusual, that it was featuring folk music in this way, that it had an integrated cast of this type, quite unusual. It lasted 5 months. I know of about a dozen transcriptions of the program that survive. I hope there are more than that. I know of about a dozen. Nicholas Ray and both Alan Lomax would continue working in radio during the war years. I came across a letter. I hope to have a slide to show you, but I came across a letter from Ray to Lomax in the summer of 41. Where he wrote to him saying that Elia Kazan, also a future film director, still thinks Back Where I Come From the best program he's ever heard on the air. With help from Kazan, Ray became a film director in Hollywood after the war. He never went back to radio, but he never forgot it either, and folk music and folklore remained part of his work. The first draft script, his first draft script for his first feature, They Live By Night, included a scene of a black convict singing the Midnight Special. He may have hoped to actually cast Leadbelly in this part, as Leadbelly was in California at the time. The true story of Jesse James, a film he did in the 50s, was originally entitled The Ballad of Jesse James, and it ends with a blind man spontaneously composing the Ballad of Jesse James just after Jesse's been shot on a street corner, with new lyrics written by Nicholas Ray. Lomax continued to work in radio as a civilian. From 46 to 49, he had a half-hour weekly show on the Mutual Network, where he was billed as Your Ballad Man. He was playing recordings by this time, and he would produce programs that frequently ventured worldwide. A show entitled Dancing Around the World's typically eclectic, features in order recordings of Chicago blues, Appalachian and Cajun fiddling, Afro-Cuban music, West African drumming, Django Reinhardt's Djangology, an Irish jig, a Finnish polka, a Slavic kola, an Israeli hora, an Armenian dance tune, a Russian chorus, a Balinese orchestra, a Western square dance, klezmer wedding music, and a Dixieland revival recording featuring Sidney Bechet and Wild Bill Davison. We'll just hear the very climax of that show.
If you thought those lads in Turkish Armenia got enthusiastic, listen to what these guys do. This is Wild Bill Davison. Well, we've danced clear around the world, from New York to New York, and we're back home again, and it's time for the folk song train to start rolling. Yes, sir, rolling right down the middle of Mutual Network in office. This is Alan Lomax, your ballad man, inviting you for another session of ballads next time.
He got another shot at a Back Where I Come From type program in 1947 with many of the same cast members as had been on Back Where I Come From. The show was called Hootenanny. It doesn't seem to have gone anywhere after the pilot, but that pilot survives, and I'll just play you a little bit. Woody was back with Cisco Houston. Pete Seeger was also in the cast. Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry were there, and Sidney Bechet can be heard in this opening here. John Henry Falk, great Texan folklorist. There's a building not far from here named for him.
Sunshine on your saddle. Y'all feel like dancing, well, sail in and dance.
Hurry up, boy, and on you go. I'm trying to win it all by no child.
There's Woody.
The Columbia Broadcasting System presents its newest musical, Hootenanny. Peter Seeger, Woody Guthrie, Cisco Houston, Sidney Bechet, Ronnie McGee, Saunders Terry, Hollywood, and the Coleman brothers are going to open up America's big folk song bag for you on Hootenanny.
So that was 1947. Television came in about that time, and you know, folk music continued to be heard on the radio, but it was no longer necessary to, you know, for it to be so tightly scripted, have these elaborate setups for thing. It tended to be a lot looser. But those are a few of the surviving highlights of folk music on the radio in the 30s and 40s. Do we have time for any questions?
Yeah, we've got about 5 minutes.
Okay. Yes.
Martin's radio program. I remember him briefly in 47, and he had as
Huh? Oh, that's great. Michael?
I had never heard that John Henry Falk had been involved with the performer's life, because you know Falk was the one who broke the blacklist.
Well, this was 47. He hadn't been blacklisted yet, so.
That's right, but that's exactly when he was blacklisted from 1954, he was the one that finally was able to,
yeah,
to get a successful lawsuit. But I had never heard it in any case, reading his book and Louis Meiser's book, that there had been any connection between him and people like P.C. or Woody Guthrie. Was that fact brought up in some of the podcasts of Falk and
That I don't know. I mean, he'd known Alan for a long time. They were lifelong friends. Yeah. Joe?
John Henry Falk went to the University of Texas alongside of Alan Lomax.
Yeah.
And married him off at that time, Hollywood.
Yeah, and Hollywood's heard on that Hootenanny program.
Alan, of course, wasn't as controversial as people like Pete Seeger, of course.
Well, Alan was able to go to England in the 50s. His name does appear in the first issue of Red Channels. So, you know, he was a marked man, you know. And if he'd stayed in the States, he might have been in considerable trouble. Yes.
So these programs were going out to schools. Have you ever encountered anyone who remembers hearing the program, or whose life, or career, or way of thinking?
Yes, I have, in fact. I have, and that's one of the things that got me interested. I've always had an interest in old-time radio anyway, but it's one of the things that got me interested in just investigating folk music on the radio. When I worked for Alan, he would occasionally mention some show he'd done that, you know, had really gone off well, and I'd think, well, gee, I'll never get to hear that. But yeah, I've talked to people who said this is the way they first heard Lead Belly, for instance. Chris.
Yeah, I guess you make a distinction between so-called folk music, unquote, and the vernacular music of the authentic folks out there, because have you done any research when the first real authentic broadcasts were made, you know, like the Carter Family or the radio or the Lancaster Doughboys on Texas stations and so on? When did that start?
Oh, much earlier than 39, yeah. I mean, there was a lot of it at the local level. And I mentioned that at the very beginning. There was Grand Ole Opry, first of all, National Barn Dance. There were big shows like that. And then there were, you know, the Monroe Brothers had a show in the 30s. Lots of people did this. Bradley Kincaid did shows all over the country, and that was probably responsible for exposing a lot of people to, you know, folk music or balladry or country, you know. Dick?
And Bradley was arguably a folk singer, very much in the rural lives and with him.
Yeah.
If Fiddlin' John Carson hadn't been broadcasting successfully in 1922, the first country record wouldn't have been made in 1923. If called to stir on radio, he never had a chance to record.
Yeah. Yeah, the distinction I would make, I'll get to you just a second, the distinction I would make, most of the people that appeared on American School of the Air, back where I come from, programs like that Alan did, they were folk musicians playing folk music, but they were professional entertainers, people who played dances and barrooms and so on. You know, they weren't convicts who were singing work songs, or people singing play party songs, or different kinds of hymnody, and that's the kind of folk music of which much less was heard on the radio, even on shows like this. Although I did mention, for American School of the Air, Alan brought on Elmer George, who was a Vermont lumberjack. On another program, they had on a Captain Robinson, who was a real shantyman from the days of sail. They brought him over to the CBS studios in New York from the Sailor's Home in Snug Harbor, Staten Island. And about the same, well, a little bit later than, concurrent with American School of the Air, Alan was involved in a thing at the Library of Congress called the Radio Research Project, where they sent field recording teams out around the country to gather material for radio programs about these different places. And some of them were focused on music. Alan led a team that went to Asheville, North Carolina, recorded the Mountain Folk Festival presented by Bascom Lamar Lunsford. There was another one, though, that just went and recorded a traveling carnival that was visiting Washington, D.C. at the time. And you get interviews with, you know, the tattooed lady and the thin man and the fat lady and so on. It's not musical at all, but it is. It gets into the realm of folklore. Yes? I've seen a few good books. No titles come to mind. You know, people have looked at, I mean, certainly things like the NBC orchestra broadcasts have been studied. There were quite a few classical music programs, and, you know, jazz discographers have really delved into, you know, jazz that was presented on the air, you know. A lot of that survives on transcription discs. There was a lot of music, live music, to be heard on the air. There are technical reasons for that. They didn't like to play records because they were noisy. The other was that there was a long simmering dispute with the musicians' union over paying royalties for spinning records on the air, and you know they just would present live orchestras, live bands to do it, and you know whatever the particulars of that dispute were at the time, I think we're pretty fortunate. We got a lot of good music out of it and recorded and pressed to higher specs than most commercial discs of the time. Okay, I think. One more? Sorry. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say the, by 1936 or 7, I can remember the National Farm and Home Hour came out of Chicago, I believe, and I think they had local cut-ins for a program after it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'd like to remind you of all of the Mexican stations that were broadcasting out of Mexico all through the South.
Yeah.
And we could get them on the West Coast. And they had all kinds of music, including the Carter family, on the radio program.
Yeah. Oh, I'm well aware of those, believe me. Yeah, you know, I just, again, to get back to the title of my paper, you know, Roots of the Revival, you know, that this was, I'm sort of looking to it as it, you know, directly affected the folk music revival. You know, Alan Lomax, major player in that, and also these musicians. I mean, you know, in these programs, we've heard Woody Guthrie, Burl Ives, Josh White, you know, key players in the urban folk revival, you know. But your point's well taken, yeah. I mean, those border radio, Mexican border radio could reach Canada on a good night. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people heard the Carter family that way. Yeah, including Woody. So, thank you.
Thanks, Matthew. That was great.